Have you ever thought about the difference between a vacation and a pilgrimage? Well, there's a very ancient tradition of pilgrimage that I think we've pretty much lost the sense of, and yet there are pieces of vacation time that really do kind of connect with that same sensibility. Jenny has just returned from what I would definitely call a pilgrimage, and she's going to talk to all of us about her amazing experience in the Holy Land. Stick around. We got a really good conversation ready to go for you. It's pretty cool that, we're getting this thing fired up again. This is one of my favorite things in the world to do, is talk to people, have a reason to do it. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
I have to admit, when I walked in the office and turned the microphone around, I was like, all right, I'm ready. Podcast time. I'm digging it.
Beautiful.
I'm good. I'm very good today.
Beautiful. How's the weather in Oak Ridge?
Allergen inducing.
Oh my gosh.
It's sunny and bright and beautiful, and yellow pollen is floating in the air, and eyes are itchy, nose are runny. It's springtime in East Tennessee.
Well, I've often said that the weather in DC is the same as in East Tennessee, just a day later. And I think that's definitely true. I went out looking for my car this morning and I couldn't find it because everything in the whole of the street was yellow. The trees, everything was, it just blended all together. My car was buried. It was ugly. It was ugly. And my eyes could tell you that that was actually also the case. So
I had to call Annette the other day during staff meeting and say, can you bring my eye drops down? I just can't take it anymore. Oh, it's a beautiful, I will say this, East Tennessee is beautiful. The dogwoods are out, flowers are popping. I mean, it really is lovely, but the yellow mist of Satan covers everything.
Yeah. You may have heard that we have cherry trees, cherry blossoms up here.
I've heard that.
You want to hear my hot take?
Yes.
They don't even begin to compare to West Outer Drive at this time of the year.
I'm not even close. I'm not even sure that's a hot take for people, except in DC. They would argue that just out of sheer loyalty, but Holly, dogwoods are so a thing.
And let's just even say Sequoia Hills has got nothing on Oak Ridge
at this time of
the year. So, yeah. Okay, cool. Hey, anything exciting happening at the church right around these times? I hear there's a sermon series about. There was a launch with that last weekend. There was outdoor worship that once again got turned around and brought indoors. And,
what's going on? We had a great time. And we started the sermon for that outdoor/indoor worship service was, I don't believe in that God either, which was really the kind of launching of a new sermon series that we're doing that's talking about all the caricatures of God that you see thrown around. And the sermon series is going to address all the different caricatures of God, the ones in a series, God of magic words, the God of hellfire, the God of America, God who plays favorites, the God of wrath. Those are all, I mean, for good reason, I think, fear, our own fears manifested, projected onto God. We're all tempted to run to these little idols instead of letting God really teach us, reveal to us.
I'm dying to get into that with you. I think we're going to be doing some podcasts, going forward about just conversations about those sermons. Who are doing those? Is it all you, or is it
pastors? Yeah, I'm doing the first one. Then Dena's doing one. I'm going back to God of America, and then God Who Plays Favorites. Jenny's actually closing the series out with God of Wrath, which I think has. I'm waiting for the heavy metal We need an intro for it, so it's got that kind of heavy bass God of Wrath quality.
Yeah, yeah. And the image I have is right now is it's, you know, I can't think of a less wrathful person than Jenny. So what does she know about?
Very true.
What does she know about wrath? I don't know. I'm dying to find out though. All right, so you've got a busy afternoon, and actually this is a conversation. I think we're just going to bring Jenny in and get started with this whole thing, and I'm going to usher you out the door, Jenny in, and we're going to talk another time about that sermon series, and I'm pretty stoked about it. I think it's going to be fun. I love the title, and just, you know, everybody that's talked to me about it, I've had no end of fun working with the graphics around that sermons series. So anyway, I think it's going to be a great set of conversations. Look forward to it, Mark.
Excellent. I do too.
Jenny, welcome to today's episode of Can the Church Be Saved? How you doing?
Thank you. Good. Good. Happy to be here.
You know, for a while you've been the only person doing the podcast officially because of Lectio Divina is part of the podcast feed, and we haven't been doing episodes of this for a while, but we're about to do a series, which I'm excited about. But I wanted to get it kicked off today because you just came back from a very special and very undoubtedly a very powerful experience, and I'd love to kind of get it while it's fresh. So we good with that?
Good. Yeah? And I'm grateful to have the chance to talk about it before I get sucked into the day-to-day life in Oak Ridge and it becomes a distant memory. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, and excuse me. I feel like it's important to, I always like being the first person to talk to somebody about an experience like this. Because once you've talked about it a few times, you know, once you start teaching Sunday school classes and talking about it, et cetera, it kind of gets, I don't know if this works with you, you're probably way better at this than I am, but when I repeat the story and talk about it, I kind of condense it down into a set of talking points, which may or may not actually be true.
Well, and as you keep repeating the story, I remember telling the story more than living the story. Yeah.
Brilliant.
So that can be a shift.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Well, where was this place that you went to? What was the context? What was the experience?
I went to the Holy Land, and I'll be honest. So this trip was originally planned back in March of 2020, and needless to say, it got postponed, and it kept getting postponed. And so part of me didn't think that it would actually ever happen. And it actually did happen. I'll also be honest that the month or two leading up to the trip, I didn't want to go anymore. And there are lots of reasons for that, some of which I don't really want to go into. But one of them is I don't like tension and discord. I like harmony. I like people to, you know, and that is a very challenging part of the world. And it has been for thousands of years. And I was very aware of that. What I wasn't prepared for was just the depth of the experience itself. I'm not a very, very visually oriented person. So when I read the Bible, I don't imagine it in my mind. You know, when I would read novels, I would skip that paragraph of description and just get right to the action of what happened. And so because of that, and because of, you know, my approach to the Bible, it's much more about the meaning of the lessons and the meaning of what Jesus did and said, and less so typically about literally what happened and all of that. So because of that, I wasn't prepared for how meaningful it was to be in that physical place, which I know sounds kind of silly because that's why you go. It's the Holy Land. But I didn't expect the physicality to be as meaningful and touching and significant as it was.
I just want to dig into that deeply. I'm going to start with a kind of a, this may sound like a kind of a sideways question or out of the blue kind of question, but which of the four gospels is your favorite?
Oh gosh.
I mean, we all, you know, it's like, I don't have a favorite child, yeah. But you know, if we, well, we don't, well, we don't have a favorite child, but most of us have a favorite gospel, one that we lean on more than another. Is that true with you, or?
That's not fully true, but if I had to pick, it would, I mean, I love the Christmas story, so you got to go with Luke, you know, the Annunciation and all of that. And yet my undergrad degree was in philosophy, so you got to love John, you know, so I go back and forth between those
two. So that was my hunch.
Probably.
And the reason I said that, because uh-huh. you know, for those lay people out there that are listening, you know, the first Matthew, Mark, and Luke kind of follow the same perspective, but then if you read John carefully, it's a different one. It's a very much more kind of high-minded, very spiritualized interpretation, really, of the Jesus story and all of his sayings, and that seems to me, just kind of as a guess, that would support the way that you might have approached this, all of this material in the past. In other words, that kind of, you didn't need to see it. You had an experience of it
right.
in the text itself, and you didn't need to see it, right?
Yeah, and it was more the experience, you know, of God in the present that has been most significant to me. And so for that, because for me, you know, whether something actually happened or not wasn't as significant as what do we get from this story? What does it teach us about God and about ourselves and our relationship with God?
Okay, and then to go back just a little bit again, you don't want to disclose all the reasons why you didn't really want to go, but could you name one or two reasons why you were just not excited about it?
I mean, so again, one of them was, as I said, that, you know, just the conflict that continues to happen in that area, and discomfort with that. Also, the group of people that I was going with, a group of people from a small seminary out in California. And 3-4 years ago, when we were initially planning that trip, I was the chair of the board of that seminary. Things have happened. I ended up resigning that position and so had taken a step away from that whole group and so hadn't really been with them since then. So wasn't sure what it was going to be like. And it ended up being delightful, really, really delightful and wonderful to be able to spend time with those people in a very different situation and removed from all of that previous
So maybe
stuff.
There's a mm-hmm. message down the road about reconciliation in a certain sense. I don't know.
Yeah.
How this place seems to have an effect on people in that way. And just the experience of traveling in general. I think when you travel with people, a friend of mine, you know, said that you only, there's only two ways. I think this is actually an Islamic saying that there's only two ways that you can truly know a person. Is one is by marrying them and two is by traveling with them. And that seems to make a lot of sense to me.
And that part of the world is very, very foreign. It is very, very different from the United States. I've traveled a lot, but in Central America and in Europe. And there, while I may not understand the language, at least I can read the language. You know, while you get to Israel, Palestine, the signs are in Hebrew and in Arabic. And if you're lucky, they're in English, but often they're not. And I mean, they're squiggles to me. They're just squiggles. And so, and as well as the languages themselves, again, are so, so very different. And so it's not easy for me to pick up. And the music, again, is very, very different. I remember the first morning that I was there, my roommate had a very, very difficult traveling thing. So she was sleeping for a few hours and I just sat out on, we had a tiny little balcony in our room and just looking, the signs that I saw were all written in Arabic. the people that I heard speaking were speaking in Arabic. Then I start hearing the music and it was like, oh, we are so not in Kansas anymore. I mean, it was just a very, very different experience. Yeah. And so to be together, you sort of do get bonded together when you're in this foreign place together, back to the relationships of the travelers.
Yeah. So you mm-hmm. started out, where did you go when you first arrived?
So when we first arrived, arrived in Jerusalem, so landed in Tel Aviv and took a cab from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I was there by myself. It was dark. I didn't dare leave the hotel, I'll be honest. The next day, when my friend, after she had slept a little bit, we went to the old city of Jerusalem. And what struck me most initially, so as were cities, you know, ancient cities, they are surrounded by a wall. And so you go there, and what do you see? You see this old, ancient, tall wall with the small gates. And you see buses and, you know, cars and craziness all around the outside. And yet when you walk into that gate, through that gate, you're in a different world. There are very, very few cars there. Most of the old city has no cars. They are cobblestone-like, but stone streets that are mostly pedestrian and stairs and old, old buildings. It was just quite remarkable, the separation, you know, between the old city and then the rest of Jerusalem. And it was only by walking through those gates, it's like, oh, this is Jerusalem. And that's when it first hit me. Just, yes, that I was in this ancient place. And it would be, I mean, I started just thinking about walls, you know, and the walls there initially, you know, are a form of protection. So a way to protect the city from invaders. And in some ways, it separates the inside and the outside. And one could, in those ways, sort of look at the secular on the outside and the sacred on the inside. But that's not true, because there was a lot of things that happened on the outside of those walls. I mean, that's where they believe that Jesus was probably crucified. It says, you know, outside the walls and the Mount of Olives and all of that. But what you see and what sort of defines when you get lost walking around in the middle on the inside, the question you have to ask is, what gate am I near? And it's the gate that orients you to where you are in Jerusalem. And that's what struck me, that, you know, we tend to sometimes criticize walls. Oh, he built a wall and we couldn't, you know, have access, you know, and that wonderful song, Christ Has Broken Down the Walls. But we need the walls for definition. But what we need to make sure is that there are gates in the walls. And when you think of Revelation and, you know, the New Jerusalem, there are very tall walls in the New Jerusalem, but there are also gates that are never closed, that are never closed. So anyway, I mean, again, I sort of think, I can't help but think theologically as I experience things, but that was what struck me in that first day of going into the old city and seeing the walls and sort of reflecting on their purpose, ongoing purpose.
So let me
ask
you this question. This is, you know, dig deep. How did you feel about being inside that walled city? And did you feel safer, or did you feel more, did it feel claustrophobic to you? Did it feel, you know?
No, it did feel safer. That's interesting. I haven't thought about this question. And what's also interesting is, I mean, as we know, this is a very complicated situation over there. But for those who don't know about, so the old city of Jerusalem is divided up into four quarters. They're not quarters in exactly the same size, but you have the Muslim quarter, the Jewish quarter, the Christian quarter, and the Armenian quarter. And so remarkably for them, I mean, at least in my experience there, they are all crammed inside these walls and for the most part doing okay and living side by side. You know, across the street from where I'm in, I met a Muslim fellow who wanted to share his faith. We sat down with him and heard that for an hour or so. And just across the little pedestrian pathway street is the church. I forget what it's called, the prison church or something. But it's where Christ may have been taken the night, you know, that he was taken to Pilate. And you see, and I don't know if he was actually taken there or not, but you see what a prison was like in from that time period. And it's all in the same very close proximity. So I actually felt very, very safe and comfortable there. I did not feel claustrophobic or, yeah. So an interesting question.
Yeah, I had a conversation with my kids recently about something similar, and we all agreed that sometimes you want to go and you want a milkshake, you just want to go to McDonald's and get one of two or three choices instead of going to Cookout,
right,
where there's like, you know, 1,000 different milkshakes that you can get and they're all good. And then how do you even deal with that? You know, the limitations are liberating in a certain sense.
Are helpful.
Interesting stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So that was very interesting. And I mean, and the idea that that is an old, old city. And so people have been walking and living and trading and worshiping within those walls for a very, very long time. And you could really feel that. I mean, again, it looked so different from a modern city. As I said, most of the ways that they were pedestrian, and then a few crazy people on their motorcycles going up the stairs and all of that, that you just had to look out for, but you'd hear them coming. But that sort of just struck me that, wow, this is an ancient city, and people, again, have been living here as well as coming here on pilgrimage for, you know, 2,000 years. And you could feel that. And so that felt very special, and it made me feel kind of small in a way, but not in a bad way, you
nice.
Know.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. So that was my sense, you know, of old Jerusalem.
Okay, so you came. One of the beauties of traveling in the Holy Land is that for those of us, especially who are professionals in this area and studied in this area, you know, it's almost more fun to visit a place that you know something about, right? If you know more about it, the more you know about it, the more stories you have to connect to a place, the more interesting. It's like, oh, I know the story behind that thing over there, you know, and that.
Yes.
That's why when I first time I went over there, I thought that's really why I want to go, because I know this place. I've heard these stories and I know. And then your reaction to it when you see it could be, you know, it can be different. It can be not what you expected. Did you have any kind of, let's just say, disappointments when you visited any places, any spiritual places that you had heard about all of your life?
Disappointments. No disappointments. Certainly some places felt more moving to me than others. And part of that is, I mean, those who know me well know I'm a contemplative. So when I went to Rome the first time, my husband was there on a trip, I went and just would go from church to church and sit there for a half hour or 45 minutes just to get the feel of the place. That doesn't always happen there. I mean, went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I can never pronounce that word. But anyway, which is one of the two places where they believe might be the tomb of Jesus. And it's a crazy madhouse. I mean, there are just so many people there. And if you get in line to see the tomb, which I didn't bother do, I confess, you know, you're in there. Okay, come on, next. I mean, you're just rushed in and out.
Let's not even talk about the police barricades that you occasionally, you know, come into in that church. Yeah.
Well, that is true too. That is true
crowd
too.
Control
so,
stuff.
So that was sort of like that church didn't do it for me because it was just too crowded and too rushed. And sadly, also when we went to Bethlehem and the Church of the Nativity, it was a very similar experience. So that's as close. But again, remember, I didn't really want to go. So I wasn't super disappointed in that I didn't have super high expectations. Yeah.
How about kind of the way some of these places have become tourist traps? Did you encounter any of that?
Well, and they have, you know, and you've got people selling, you know, their wares on every corner. But, you know, then we remember that was one of the times that Jesus got ticked off was the money changers in the temple. So somehow that seemed very appropriate. But it certainly was the quieter places that felt most meaningful to me.
So tell us about
those. So the first one was, so we took a bus, you know, outside of the city to the Mount of Olives, and then got off the bus and then walked down the Mount of Olives, and went, you know, to this, you know, and what I remember, I made a couple of things, of course, you know, is Palm Sunday.
And let me just interrupt
but also
here
remembering,
for the listener, you know, if you're not familiar with the geography, the Mount of Olives is one of the, what is it, three or four mountains or hills? They're not really mountains. I mean, Jerusalem itself is on a mountain, but it's one of the hills that surrounds Jerusalem, and it's an easy walk it's an hour's walk maybe from the center of Jerusalem up to the very top of the Mount of Olives. So all of these places are in very close proximity, right?
Yeah. Right. And you go through there, the Kidron Valley, and that was one of like, oh, so this place is real. You know, it's the first time I saw that struck me, which surprised
me. The Hinnom Valley, which, of course, you know, the Greek is Gehenna, which is translated into hell. Did you get that? I mean, and it's a soccer field now.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, but that's also where there were a bunch of cemeteries, yeah, at least the part that we saw, you know, between the Mount of Olives and the city of Jerusalem.
Sure, go ahead. I digress. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I love geography, yep. And I'm
anyway,
sorry about
anyway.
That.
Anyway, so it was certainly, yeah, moving, you know, walking down. We walked down the Mount of Olives and remembering that Jesus did there. There's a church called something like Dominus Flavit, which means the Lord wept. But that's what I remembered is Jesus, you know, at one point just looking at the city and weeping. And part of me thinking of all the ongoing conflict there and the distortion and the fighting, you know, I could relate to that. And then we got to the place, to Gethsemane, which they call, what did they call it? The place of agony, I think, of Jesus's agony. And then I loved it because the little sign said free admission. And I thought, well, isn't that apropos? You know, we get in free to the place of agony, you know. But that place, just seeing these old olive trees, you know, and of course they weren't quite 2,000 years old, but they were still very old. And the agony, and part of me could, I was very moved by that place. And thinking, you know, when I was young in my, you know, late teens and 20s, I was under the impression that, yeah, you struggle for a few years and then you just get it together and you and God, you're on a good place, and that you just sail through life after that because, you know, you and God were good. And this reminded me, okay, if Jesus was wrestling and saying, please take this cup from me, it reminded me the spiritual path, no matter how much we strive to love God, it's full of challenges. And to love, you know, I used to think once I made that decision, it would be easy to love everyone. Well, I don't know, maybe other people are more spiritually advanced than I am, but it's not always easy for me to love people. And it's not easy for me to do at times what I feel like God is asking me to do. And so I could really feel that. And as I sat there, you know, and found a quiet place to sit. The sun came out and the sun was just shining strongly on my face. And I just remembered that beautiful hymn, you know, when I fall on my knees with my face to the rising sun, oh, Lord, have mercy on me. And it was just the concept of mercy, that God is present in our agony, in our suffering, when we do horrible things to each other. It's not that God wants us to do that, or but I guess that was the power of the whole trip, was the strength of mercy. And God's with us, not because we deserve it, but especially when we don't, and when we need that love and that mercy. So that's what hit
there's some
me
great pictures
there
of
in
you at
in
the garden that we I think we posted yeah. on Facebook, but there's some great pictures
yeah.
there, and there's one where you're not facing the camera. I can see the olive trees there, and I
yeah.
don't know what your face looked like, but I think I do. Even though it's not, you know, even though you're facing away from the camera, there's a
yeah.
sense that you're in a place, you're in a moment there. You're yeah.
Oh, I mean, the tears were streaming down and it was kind of interesting because now the garden is walled off. So you're on the other side of the garden, and there's, you know, the bars, and it's almost like you're looking through a prison. I mean, thankfully I've never been in prison, so I don't know. But it was incredibly powerful, and it was painful. And a good friend of mine who was there, she also was in tears, and she said, "We just keep messing it up. We just keep messing it up. You know, just the way we crucified Jesus, we're still doing that." And I was like, "Yeah, but God's not done with us yet." So it was that wonderful paradox of misery and challenge, and yet the strong felt presence of God, and that God isn't done. And so for me, the faith is, you know, there are times when I'm thinking, you know, God, what were you thinking when you gave us free will? I mean, because we have done horrible things with it. And yet my faith is, I need to trust that God knew what God was doing. Yeah. Yeah.
So
that was, I mean, that was the power of Gethsemane.
So name another mm-hmm. sublime moment, if you will.
Another sublime moment. So after we left Jerusalem, we went down, you know, into the Jordan Valley, and we went to Jericho, which is one of the oldest cities ever. And then we took these cable cars up to this monastery that was up there. And it's called the Mount of Temptation. And it's not a mountain like those of us from East Tennessee. It looked nothing like the Smokies. It was extremely steep, and it was barren rocks that was filled with caves. And so the belief is that, you know, it's not far from the River Jordan. And so the reason why it's called the Mount of Temptation is the belief is that is where Jesus went for those 40 days when he went into the wilderness, and, you know, which finished by the temptation of the devil. And so we went up there, and, you know, there was a gift shop and there was a nice little restaurant. The monastery was unfortunately closed. And I mean, again, it's a pretty steep drop off. But I saw one member of our group kind of go around this little building sort of towards the caves. And it's like, okay, if Devin can do it, I can do it. So I bravely went there with him. But what just drew me was, I don't know what, but part of me was like, what I would give to be able to live in one of these caves for a week, a month, a year. I mean, there was just something pulling me towards those caves. And I don't know. I mean, I love the whole history of the desert fathers and mothers.
And That has probably something to do with it, but we die. Keep going.
Bless
keep
him.
Going. I'm sorry.
Bless him. Yeah. But you know, the desert fathers and mothers, which were lived, you know, in the desert of Egypt in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, were the first monastics. And certainly, again, I'm a contemplative. But it was just the starkness of that place and the barrenness of that place, and these caves in these walls and these birds flying in and out of the caves, in and out of the caves. And we did get to one small one. And when I walked in, I startled some birds and they startled me as they flew out. But I don't fully understand that experience, but it was very, very powerful. Yeah. Just being in that place. And again, I think, yeah, I mean, you read about, you know, that Jesus went off to pray and he had many moments of that quiet. And part of that appeals very much to me. What was painful?
What was painful? What kind of painful experiences did you have while you were over there?
What was painful was Bethlehem. You know, so that is the place where, you know, Jesus, I mean, we don't even really know that, came into the world, and Bethlehem, and again, I don't want to get too much into politics because that's just a dicey and it can be divisive and problematic.
Bethlehem is Palestinian. Yeah. You'll never get to the bottom of
it. But,
so.
But,
just keep going. We're talking about
it's complicated.
Your experience.
No, it's, I mean, yes. But so Bethlehem is Palestinian. And so, and yet part of Bethlehem has where they believe Rachel's bones were. So that, of course, is very, very holy to the Jewish folk. So that is one of the places where you see the wall that separates, separates Israel from Palestine. And so that's where we met some people who, you know, and you can see from that wall one of the Palestinian refugee camps where people went to stay for a little bit and have, I mean, we met somebody who's been born and raised there. And so that was painful. You know, then you have the Church of the Nativity, which, I mean, that didn't quite work for me emotionally. And then we went from there to stay with in the city in the town right next door, which was I think called Shepherds of the Fields of the
Beis
Shepherds.
Ahur.
So you see, yeah, you see again. I couldn't ever learn the Arabic, so I trust you. But you see the fields. So driving from Bethlehem to this town, you see the fields, and it's like, oh my gosh. That's where the shepherds were. And you could imagine the angels, you know, coming down. But anyway, so we go from there to staying with this Christian Palestinian family who, long story that I won't go into, but, you know, believe that they need to live there because his belief was, well, when Jesus comes back, he's going to come back to the same place where he was born and he needs to have his people here. So as hard as things are for them, that's why he wants to stay. But when I asked him, how do you maintain hope within this kind of lifestyle? And he teared up and he says, my goal is not hope, my goal is survival.
Wow.
That was painful. Yeah. That was incredibly painful to hear. You know, in this holy of holy places, there are some people that are living in holy hell. And I wrestle, you know, it is extremely complicated. You can't, you know, yeah. You know, the other painful place,
of
course, was going
to
Holocaust Museum.
Says, yeah. You know, you go to the Holy Land once, you want to write a book. You want to tell everybody. You go the second time and you're like, I think I could probably write a good article about it. And then the third time, you don't know what to write. So it's just the more you learn, the more it just, you know, your ideas about all of it just tend to unravel, I think.
Right. And I think I mean, I didn't go there, you know, as a star-eyed, you know, Christian just waiting to walk where Jesus walked. You know, as I said, and my goal was to be open to the experience without judging, without bringing, as best as I could, it's impossible to leave your preconceived notions at home at the door, but trying to just be open to the experience, knowing, you know, I'm a doer, I'm a fixer, I'm a pastor, I take care of other people, I'm a mama, I'm a wife, I take care of other people. And for these 2 weeks, there was nobody for me to take care of. So I could leave all of that, and the fixer, I know it's so complicated, I have no illusions that I can make any difference there at all. But that in some way freed me up to just be there and to hear different people. And this tour, I mean, they gave us very different perspectives. We met with an Israeli settler who felt fully justified in what, you know. So anyway, we saw many different sides.
Before I cut you off, you were about to say something about the Holocaust Museum.
Well, I was saying, you know, painful. Yes, yeah, so it's painful hearing this Palestinian, you know, talk about hope is, you know, way beyond, you know, its survival. But we went to the Holocaust Museum, and I don't do well. I don't watch scary movies. I don't watch poignant movies because I feel it. And so part of me just, you know, I'll just wait for you all outside. But it's like, no, you can't do that. So I did try to protect myself, and my way of protecting myself at the Holocaust Museum was I read none of the personal stories. I know that's the most important, but I could not, you know. And when I got to the one section of the camps, I confess, I just looked down and I walked through that room. It was emotionally too much. But on some level, you can't begin to understand the contemporary, the modern Holy Land without acknowledging the Holocaust and without acknowledging that anti-Semitism is alive and well and flourishing in many places.
And they, you know, there are people so will remind you that the gas chambers are only 75 years away. That's it. You know, that's not a long period of time. My dad lived a good bit longer than that, you know. And and the other piece of it is just that, you know, when I realized that you're talking to people who, you know, have their family gatherings in Israel, and they're looking around the table, and they know that at least half of the people that should be there are not there. It's mind-blowing, and the pain and the trauma of that is incomprehensible to me.
It is incomprehensible. Yeah. And yet, you know, and I don't have the emotional fortitude to open myself up fully to that. And yet, that is a huge part of the Jewish history. And you cannot begin to understand them without taking all of that in. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a place that I went out of obligation and had no desire.
Yeah.
And yet here we are. Here we are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those were the most painful.
Any big
heart
takeaways so far? I mean, it's early. You know, it's you're gonna, we talked a little bit before the before we started recording about how, you know, there's a point at which we start kind of codifying these stories, kind of boiling them down to their essence. And that takes time. And sometimes that's not so good because there's always more to the story than what we kind of distill it down to. But you know, at this point for you, any big takeaways, any big flashes of lightning, anything that you know will change the way.
I mean, the big takeaway is, you know, I remember saying in a sermon not long ago, you know, when it's a beautiful sunny day, we say, oh, truly, this is the day which the Lord hath made, you know, and we thank God and da-da-da-da-da. And it's very easy you know, for us to think that when things are going the way we want them to go, that God is present. The takeaway, you know, and then I think, I mean, because the last other little really moving thing was the Church of the Annunciation. And I've never been a big Mary person, you know, and part of that is, you know, I'm not Catholic, and the Catholics, you know, tend to pray to Mary and all of that. But I found that place very, very moving. And, you know, just sort of the irony of Mary, you know, what does she say? You know, from now on, all generations will call me blessed. And certainly to the idea to be able to bring our Savior into the world is truly a amazingly blessed experience. But then I think, well, who was at the foot of the cross? It was Mary. And what must that have been like? That is not blessed in my, you know, in my view. So Mary is a very complicated, again, figure. And yet what I always remember, you know, from the Annunciation, you know, and this is, you know, again, why perhaps one of the reasons I love Luke, you know, she doesn't understand it. She doesn't see how this can possibly happen, but it finishes with her saying, "Here I am, a servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." So her willingness to go along with God's plan, knowing, yeah, so here she is, an unwed, you know, mother, and hey, how am I going to explain this one to Joseph, you know, as well as the rest of her family and all of that. And yet she went along with it. So to me, the takeaway and the challenge is to somehow accept the beauty and the pain, which is the deeply spiritual experience. You know, just because you're spiritual does not mean you are going to have an easy life. And Christians, if anyone, we should get that when we see not, you know, of course, what happened to Mary, but what happened to Christ. And the agony of Gethsemane. But that doesn't mean that we should accept that blindly. I am not a, you know, we are called to action. We are called to speak up for the disenfranchised and to do everything that we can to improve people's lives. But we're not going to get it right completely. And I don't think in this lifetime, any of us, it's going to ever be peaches of cream and cream. But that God is with us in the day to day. Because, you know, the last little part was going to Jaffa, you know, off of Tel Aviv, and to the house of Simon the Tanner, you know, which is where Peter had his big revelation about, you know, opening up to the Gentiles. And it just struck me, this huge revelation that changed the course of Christianity happened just in this guy's house, Simon the Tanner. You know, he happened to be staying there. And it's this small little place that's off the beaten path, and it's not a big tourist destination. You can't go in. But again, the power of God in the day-to-day. And it just made Peter feel much more real.
I think for me, the value has been in those kind of humanizing moments. I'm a big, you know, I'm one to project into the cosmos, you know, and think of these stories in kind of cinematic terms. You know, it's Cecil B. DeMille kind of visions of scripture. Simon the Tanner's house. I know exactly where it is. And all of you skeptics out there say, "Oh, it's not. How do you know it was?" It's highly likely. And if it wasn't there, then it was really close. So, you know, you can, it might as well have been there. But it's the way that all of these enormous stories are kind of brought down to the ordinary, and then the ordinary is lifted up into the extraordinary. Right? It's. It's an understanding. I still sometimes have a hard time wrapping around my head this verse out of the Gospel of John, where I think it's Philip is asked about it, and he's like, "Oh, what good's ever come out of Nazareth?" You know, and if you go to Nazareth, it's just a little town in the world. You know, they're bigger, they're more important places, yeah. And it's just this little bitty place, a dot on the map. And of course, everything we know in this world is just a tiny little speck in the solar system. And then the solar system is just a tiny, you know, yeah. And to me, visiting these places, it's about understanding the, the particularity of what God's doing in the world and how big things, massive things are happening in the most out of the way places that we never hear about. Lives that are exemplary in the kingdom's work that we never will never encounter. It's not that we don't hear them. We'll never hear about them. And yet they're what it's all about.
They're what it's all about. Yes. And so certainly, in my work and visiting with people, as they come to the end of their lives and hearing about their lives and what some of them chose to do, it's like, oh, another saint of the church that will never be identified that way. Yeah. But yeah, that fascinating, the particular versus the universal, and somehow both are true, and beauty and pain, and somehow both and true, and glory and suffering, and somehow both are true and very, very present there. Yeah, I mean, that was what, by the Sea of Galilee. So first of all, it sort of surprised me. All right, it's a big lake. Sorry, I should have known better, but I thought, I was thinking, salt water and all of that. It's just a big lake. And there's not a whole lot there, which is also kind of beautiful, because then you can imagine Jesus just landing on the shore and talking to people. And it could happen anywhere. And that is what he did for the bulk of his.
It does happen anywhere.
Yes. That? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that is one of our many blessings.
Hey, this has been fun. I knew it would be. How did I do? Did I stay out of the way in this?
You did great. He was worried, just for you all to know, he has led tours to the Holy Land and has some very, very strong beliefs, convictions, and experiences. And his goal was to zip it, and you zipped very, very well.
I hope
well.
So, because I think that it's for all of us, it's a Rorschach test, and my experience is valid, but so is yours, and everybody else that encounters this place. We're equally, our experience is equally valid and respectable, and it's got to be, we need to hear all of it. I mean, that's the only way, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, mine's more right than anybody else's, but that's okay. Who would I be me if I had not just made that little statement? Anyway.
You had to get one of those in there.
Had to do it. All right. So what's next, Jenny? You've been asked to teach some Sunday school classes, things like that. Let people know about what your experience is like. Do you have any plans yet? Do you have anything coming together there or what?
I don't have plans yet. What I'm thinking is, I'll want to be showing pictures and all of that. I'm thinking it's probably more than can be done in one Sunday school class. So what I may do is look at the church calendar in the next couple of months and just try to find two Sundays back to back where maybe they haven't been told this, but I may impose on the fellowship class to see if I could use the fellowship hall and just invite people, from all classes to come to that. And then if people can't come to that and a specific Sunday school class wants me to come, I could also come and just talk about a specific aspect instead of the whole overview. But lots of people, I've actually been quite touched that people were following my visit, because I don't Facebook. You were putting this on Facebook, but I never saw anybody's responses while I was there. And one good friend of mine, she said, I'd always heard of the Wailing Wall, but I didn't, it felt seeing your picture there made it feel so much more real. And so we are all connected. So again, I was very touched. I was also touched that people were concerned about my well-being and
Yeah, just say another thing about that. That may have been more that, that's every time I've organized a trip, the first question is, well, is it safe? How do you feel when you get on the ground? How did you feel? What was your, did you feel safe?
I never felt unsafe. I never felt unsafe, you know, and part of that is, I mean, I've lived in New York City and I've lived through that fine. But also we had guides who know the area. And I trusted them, and they altered our itinerary depending on what was going on a little bit. And so, you know, we don't need to go there right now. And so I trusted them. And yeah, is it a little startling when you go around a corner and you see a soldier standing there with a huge rifle? Yeah, that was a little startling. But I never felt any way threatened or unsafe. Maybe I should have. I mean, there was an incident that happened just about 6 blocks from our hotel in Tel Aviv a week after we got back. But no, I felt safe.
Yeah, and you were there during a time where there was stuff to kind of worry about. This was these huge protests,
yes,
in the Israeli parts of the territories where you know, these anti,
yes,
anti-,
and I mean,
protests.
At one point. Yes, and at one point the airport was, yeah, closed 2 days before we were supposed to leave. And it was like, oh, and so we asked our guide, so is this normal? And they're like, no, this is not
normal.
How about
that?
Yeah. But what it was Israelis protesting against the Israeli government. So as an American, I didn't feel dragged in. It wasn't between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which is, can be a source of violence. So yeah.
And I think Americans,
so it was,
you know,
interesting.
I grew up thinking about Arafat and the Munich Olympics, things like that. And I grew up thinking Palestinians,
yeah,
are, you know, they're all out to get me. And did you have any experience that would lead you to believe that in reality? Yeah.
No. I mean, and when we asked the Palestinians that we stayed with, you know, what do you want us to take away? You know, when we talked a little bit and which of our presidents they liked better than others and all of that. They said, we want you to witness. We want you to witness and remember and to tell people what we are experiencing. And the Israelis were also very warm and welcoming. Yeah.
Well, Jenny,
mm-hmm,
I look forward to the next trip you go on when you start leading tours and how you help.
Know.
You know, you're not going to do that. You don't think so?
That's your path, not,
yeah,
mine.
I think it's my.
Nope.
I think,
nope, not,
I think
a
that
guide.
Was my path. I think I've. I don't know if I could. I'm struggling with my ability to lead those trips in the future because it is, I go to the depths of it. I go to Hebron. You know, I take groups to Hebron, and that's the worst of the worst. And I just,
yeah, and we did not,
yeah,
go there.
No, it's hard. It is hard to see. And I've got friends.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem. I've got good friends now they live in a house right by that that's surrounded by the wall on three sides of their home, and
yeah,
just, I love them. They're wonderful people, but man, to hear the pain and the constant,
yeah,
fear of what's about to happen next, you know, and it's just, it's hard for me to take. I turned 60,
yeah,
this year.
And I mean,
you know,
that being
so.
Saying, I mean, one last example, if I could just go on for two or three more minutes.
Please.
One of the most moving other things was there is a Christian Palestinian family that has a farm, and they, unlike a lot of other Palestinians, they have a deed. It is legally theirs, and yet that is not always recognized by the Israelis. And they have had full, mature olive groves decimated by bulldozers. They have had fruit trees that were ready to be harvested decimated by bulldozers. And if that was me, man, I would be ticked off and angry and yada, you know, and I'm sure they are. But they have a rock painted on their farm that says, something to the effect of, I refuse to be enemies. And what the woman talked about when she tells this story is, yes, we could give in to the anger and to the hatred, but she said that is not what Jesus calls us to do. So when these horrible things happen, she said, well, what good can I do? And she says, well, I'll plant another tree. I'll plant another tree.
And a little piece of and trivia that was like, for you, Jenny, and for the listeners, is that James Frank Wilson, Pat Wilson, Wayne Holberg, I'm blanking on the number of people in the right. Myron and Kerry Iwanski have Linda Holberg have planted trees. They some of those trees in that place.
Bob Cantrell.
Yeah, they've planted people we know have planted those trees.
Yeah. Yes. 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 But it's like, talk about truly living out one's faith. Yep. You know, they're not, they are still fighting for their farm, as you know. So that's not that they're being overly passive, but that they are not giving in to the anger and the hatred is truly remarkable. And their goodwill is amazing.
I'm going to wrap it up. I think that I have to say one more thing, and you know, of course, as I want to do, that's why I think it's why I'm so fascinated with the place, is because it's pacifism and it's nonviolence, but it's not passivity. It's forward nonviolence.
Yeah.
It's a nonviolence that confronts the powers that are trying to, you know, take away.
Yeah, they speak the truth.
What Jesus did in that land, and so that's why, to me, it makes all of these stories come alive to see how people are taking his story, his example, and applying it in a very risky, take up your cross and follow me kind of way every day. And how powerful that witness really is. And yet it's tough too. So anyway, thanks so much, Jenny. This is huge. Yep.
You're welcome.
And,
Thank you.
We look forward to talking about it a little bit more. Thanks. Experiences like this are really, really amazing. And I think it's one of those situations where somebody else has a great experience. They come back and talk about it. You remember when you went to camp when you were a kid and you had such an amazing time, but you went back and told everybody about it and they're like, I don't get it. Give Jenny a hard listen in all of this, please. Listen to what she's got to say. Listen to what her observations are, and do as much as you can to engage in the openness that she discovered in that part of the world and all the things that she learned. Please also put on your calendar a couple of opportunities that she's going to be having to speak to the congregation about her experience. Can't make it until July, but watch the newsletter, watch First Things, so you can have it ready to go in your calendar, be there, all that good stuff, when it happens, because I know you're going to want to hear what she's got to say. Thanks for listening. This has been really an enlightening conversation. I really hope that all of these conversations are enlightening. Next up, we're going to be talking with the church staff, especially the pastors, about this beautiful, beautiful, interesting sermon series that we've got going forward. So please like and subscribe and do all that good stuff, and join us again next time for Can the Church Be Saved?